Lay. Let's start. Now recovered basically all the basic node architecture stuff. Okay, so what's next? What's the content of today is to go through some through the networking stuff. Okay, so since most of the supercomputers and clusters we have nowadays are distributed memory machines, this lecture will give you an introduction on how those computers are connected usually. We will have a more in-depth discussion once we look at the actual supercomputers and how they are actually interconnected. But today we are going over a very brief overview. Okay, so a network is usually some kind of hardware and a protocol with it. Okay, and that means that we have wires, right? And the electrical signals that go over the wire need to be interpreted somehow, and that's the protocol, right? So what we had so far with the CPUs, with the chips, is that we had usually some kind of on-chip network, right? Which interconnected the different cores and the different peripherals and the main memory, which is what we usually call a bus or something like that, right? We saw some more complicated networks with the Zen architecture and the Skylake architecture, and now we are focusing on the off-node communication. So the networks that you well probably are most familiar with are Ethernet, right? So Ethernet is more or less the wired connections. Please come in. Are some wired connections that go over where you plug some cable in your computer and into a switch and then that's it, right? And other networks that haven't survived is, for example, the MiriNet network. And well, current networks are well, gigabit Ethernet, 10 gigabit Ethernet, 20 gigabit, 40 gigabit, or InfiniBand. And InfiniBand is what's currently used the most. In most systems, we have some kind of InfiniBand hardware. Okay, and the design goals is that we kind of get a general purpose network, right, which is compatible with each other, is fault tolerant, right? So that means that whenever we plug the cable off, or a switch dies, or a node dies, that the network doesn't break down, and it needs to be flexible, right? Flexible in the terms of that we can just easily plug in another computer or so, right? So Ethernet is quite flexible, right? The stuff that's built around Ethernet and on top of Ethernet and other networks is, for example, the TCP stuff. And the internet is built on top of TCP, among other protocols, and that's pretty flexible, right? And it can be extended with Wi-Fi or whatever, right? What we require in order to get a high performance network is that we get low latency, low overhead, and of course, high bandwidth, right? So that's our main goals.
InfiniBand, so how much speed we're talking about in InfiniBand?
InfiniBand, we currently get, I think the fastest are 56 gigabits per second.
56.
56,
But did I imagine that kind of network, and inside of a data center, no, imagine.
Well, inside of a cluster, yeah, inside of a supercomputer, for example. So most data centers, for example, the cloud data centers. The different machines they have in the data centers for cloud computing are usually not connected via InfiniBand. Okay, so they usually use some kind of Ethernet, right? Because it's cheaper. Okay. Yeah, because it's mass production and therefore it's cheaper, right? Yeah. But some do have InfiniBand as well.
Okay. And they use, imagine they use like monomode, how you say, fibers, no?
Fibers, optical, depends. Huh? Depends. Okay, so for long distance, usually you usually use optical fibers, and for small distances, you usually use copper. Okay.
But the thing is that you can, I imagine you cannot achieve 56 gigabits with a Ethernet normal cable, no? Oh yeah.
Not with a normal cable, no. So it needs to be special cables, of course. Okay. Usually, so they need to be shielded in a special way, right, and arranged in a special way, so they don't, so the different fibers in a cable don't speak to each other, right, and then the connector where you put the cable into your hardware need to be laid out specially, right, so you don't lose too much information when you plug it in, right, where the connectors happen, and so that's the basic difference, right? So if you have, for example, right, so this is your usual Ethernet cable, right? You probably have seen one of those, and with this kind of cable, right, which is a very basic cable, it's not very thick, and you have, I think it's eight cables inside, right? And with this kind of cable, you don't get more than 100 megabits, if even, right? Okay. Probably 10 megabits.
I think you can reach 1 gigabit.
1 gigabit? With that one? No. Unlikely. Very unlikely. But 100 megabits, maybe 10 megabits usually, okay? Because if we would cut it open, we would see some aluminum around it, around each pair, around each cable, right? And they are twisted, and then you have the plastic around, right? And this doesn't even have aluminum around it, right? So you just can't achieve that high data rates, right? The higher the frequency, the higher the possibility that the cables speak with each other, right? With via interference and things like that. Electromagnetic interference, yeah. And so you need special cables and you need special hardware that actually is capable of processing the high frequency signals. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, we need high bandwidth, low overhead, low latency, right? So let's look at the topologies of the different network architectures first. So if we want to connect 1,000 or even 10 computers with each other, right, we have to think about, or well, maybe not 10, but in the order of 1,000 computers with each other, we need to think about how we connect them together, right? So one example would be that we just use a full crossbar interconnect, okay? So this is an example of of the latest supercomputer which had a full crossbar interconnect, the Earth simulator. Okay, and it consisted of 640 nodes. Okay, and each of the nodes were fully connected with each other. Okay, that means that you had a direct connection from one node to the other node. Okay, and of course, that's the best you can get, right? It's very fast, right? And you can achieve a very high bandwidth. You have very low latency. So, what else could we wish for, right? And the problem with that is, which you might already see in that picture, is that it requires lots and lots of cables, right? So lots and lots of cables and also lots and lots of ports to actually connect into the nodes, right? So with the 640 nodes, so each node needed 640 ports, network ports, in order to connect with the other nodes, right? And in total, you had 83,200 electric cables, right? Which is quite a lot. So in general, you require in the order of n squared cables for your fully connected network topology, right? But the performance you get out of it is probably the best you can get. However, it costs you a lot, right? And it might not be feasible with a higher node count, right? So another thing we can do is we can connect them in some kind of tree fashion, right? So that means we have so-called tree topology. And the problem with the tree is if we draw it, right? So if we have our computer, our nodes here, so node 0, node 1, node 2, and node 3, right? We connect them in a tree fashion. So we have a switch here. Have a switch here, and then one more at the root of the tree, right? So the problem here is that if we want to communicate from N0 to N3, for example, right, we have to go over the root node, right? And also, if you want to talk from if N1 wants to communicate with N2, right, it also has to go through the root node. That means that those links that are closer to the root have a high probability of getting congested with traffic, right? So if both N0 and N1 wants to talk with the other half, right, the bandwidth, the aggregated bandwidth that they can achieve is limited by the root node bandwidth, right? So that's why we have the FAT tree topology. That means that the links to the nearer to the root are actually wider, so you have more links the closer you get to the root. Okay, so the thing is, if you want to have a collective operation, that means, for example, that you want to broadcast a value from N0 to all the other nodes, that's actually the most efficient network that you can get, right? Because when you broadcast it, the switches can handle it, and then the communication takes logarithmic order, right? Because you can, you only have to go through the switches, right? The problem here is that if you have very large scale installations, that you require also longer and longer cables, right? And the speed of light obviously limits the scalability here, right? The more nodes we have at the bottom, the higher our tree gets, the more cables we need, and the longer the distance for communication is, and the more time the signal takes to propagate through the system. Okay, so here's another picture of a FAT tree, right? So it doesn't have to be a binary tree, right? So one of those switches can, for example, take up 4 nodes, right? And then we just get fatter and fatter the closer we get to the root, right? That's the basic idea, essentially, to get some kind of FAT tree topology. And yeah, so the problem is, or the limitation of that network is that if we want to have neighborhood communications, right? So for example, take your CVA exercise. where you have this stencil operation, for example, where you need to communicate from with your neighbors, right? For example, you would need to communicate your boundaries, exchange your boundaries between those nodes, right? You always have to go through that switch, right? So you have an increased latency, right? So the question is whether we can actually improve this neighborhood communication scheme, right? Because that's what, at least in the past, the most common operation was, having those stencil operations, right? So the answer to that question is the torus topology, right? It's, as mentioned, it's very good for the physical simulation codes, so the stencil-like codes, and it scales very, very well, right? The other nice property is that we have fixed length cables. However, it's very bad for collectives. And this is an example, two-dimensional torus, okay? So it looks like a donut, right? Higher dimensional tori are a little more difficult to visualize like that. But you can, well, planarize it to some extent. So here are three examples of a one-dimensional torus, a four-dimensional torus, and a three-dimensional torus. And a one-dimensional torus looks a little bit like a necklace or something, right? So you just align the nodes on one closed string, right? So what you can see here is that I mentioned that we have a fixed length cable, right? But here we see that the connection from node 0 to the fourth node is actually way longer, right? So the way how you can fix that to get your fixed length back is if you construct your torus. So instead of just aligning them right next to each other, if we have our four node setup, right? What we could do is that, okay, we go here, right? And instead of that link going to the rightmost node, we just hop on to that one, right? And here we hop on to that one. And that's how we get our torus topology, but with fixed length cables, more or less, right? We move that more up higher and that down a little bit, then we can actually achieve our fixed length torus network. Right?
One thing in this case, you will use the nodes as switches.
The nodes are more or less the switches, yeah. Yeah. So if you In those examples, you can see immediately that the collective operations are kind of bad, right? Because you need to hop through all of those, right? And if you require a not a neighborhood communication pattern, but something else, it's getting a little bit more complicated, right? But still, if you have such a two-dimensional torus, right, your two-dimensional stencil is quite good for that because you reach your neighbors with one hop directly. Right. Yeah.
And have you seen an installation of this kind of topos?
Yes.
They use static routes or dynamic routes?
The classical torus uses a static routing, right? But one example of a more modern network is the network that's built into the Cray supercomputers. Okay, the Cray supercomputers. Cray is a supercomputer manufacturer, and they build their own networks, right? They called it Dragonfly topology, and that's kind of like a torus network, but dynamically routed. Okay. But we will talk about that later. Okay. All right. Good. Is it clear how the construction of such a torus network works?
For 1D, yes. For 2D, it's pretty difficult to visualize.
Okay.
So for 2D, like 2D.
It's so the construction is actually pretty as can be. So if it's printed like that, it's a little difficult. I agree. So let's look at it step by step. Okay. So
you paint it like this, because we've seen it this way. If you paint it like this way, it will be more easy to see. So, turn 90 degrees.
So. So let's see. So we have our 4-node 1D torus network. Okay. Okay. So let's print it like that. Okay. And if you want to extend, if you want to add another node, right? Then we would just add it here. And extend the links, right? If we want to extend it to be a two-dimensional torus, we essentially need to double the number of nodes, right? So that means that we would add another 5 nodes, right? Make our one-dimensional torus, and then add the connection down. So that's it, right? If you want to add another row, we just add our nodes, right? Add our links. And then of course we need to connect it back to the top. So, yeah, it again looks very, yeah, not so nice anymore, right? But the nicer visualization is actually like this, right? Where you have this donut kind of shape.
And for 1D, it would just be like this kind of circle, right?
Yeah. So it's just a circle where you line up your nodes. The higher dimensional tori are a little bit more complicated, right? But the construction is similar. So we would just add, we would just add layers and connect them, the layers with each other. Yeah.
And in each corner of the cube, there is a cable, no? Like this. So in the three dimensional torus, like for example, in each corner, you need like a outline cable too, no?
So each node has the same connectivity, right? So in the two-dimensional case, it's 4. In the three-dimensional case, it should be 8. Yeah.
That's why I think there are cable missing. It's not there in the
three-dimensional. No.
For example, in the second corner, the one on the right.
Yeah.
Should be a cable outside.
Yeah, and one to the top. Yeah, or is it? Yeah, right. So that's a very nice topology, since the number of ports we need in each node are just 2 to the power of the dimensions that we have, right? And the only problem is that the latency to the other end of the network is a little bit higher than with having, for example, a tree network or a fully connected network. Okay, so what we have in the supercomputers that actually use a torus topology, they usually have something like a 5-dimensional or 6-dimensional torus network. Okay. All right. So let's look at the actual protocol that's built on top of those still abstract connections, right? So the means of how they would be connected with each other are that you would have some kind of network interface card and some cables that go from one node to the other, right? That's the physical layer, so to say, right? And on top of that, we need some kind of protocol of layering that you can build your protocols on top. So what we have what you see normally when you go on the internet or some other network is that you have the OSI layering model. Okay, it consists of seven layers, where the lowest layer, as I mentioned, is the physical layer, right, which is the fabric that connects the computer, right? So for Ethernet, we have the copper cables or even optical link cables. For Wi-Fi, we have the airwaves the electromagnetic waves that connect to the Wi-Fi access point, and so on, right? And then we have the data link layer, which determines the actual signal kind of thing, right? So the connection. Then we have the network layer, which means which is usually the layer that assigns unique addresses and mostly unique addresses to your specific node that you're connected to it. On top of that network layer, you can build your transport layer, right? So that means that you have some kind of protocol which the messages have to adhere to, right? So the interesting thing is that you can actually talk to the other computers via each layer, right? So on the physical layer, you would have to put in some electrical signals, right? And at the other end, you would have some kind of oscilloscope or something where you look at what gets out of the other end of the cable, right? On the data link layer, you have your Ethernet frames. So for the example of Ethernet, where you have some frames which have special meaning, right? Then on the network layer, you actually put some more information with actual addressing on it, right? So if you have your data link layer, everything just flows through the network. In the example of Ethernet, for example, you would just broadcast your signals over your network, right? And the network with the help of the network layer, you are actually able to route the packets that come from the data link layer to the actual end nodes, right? To the nodes where they belong to, right? Then with the transport layer, you get a additional protocol on top of it, which you can use to actually do some meaningful stuff. So here the examples are TCP and UDP. UDP is a connection-less protocol, stands for Unreliable Datagram Protocol, where you just put your packets out on the network and the receiving end tries to read it, but you don't get any guarantee on whether the packets arrived or whatever. So most computer games, for example, use UDP for their multiplayer gaming. Yeah. Streaming? Yeah? Okay. Depends. If you want some reliable connection, however, you probably want to use something like TCP, right? And TCP as a protocol actually defines has acknowledgements and synchronizations, etc., where you can at the protocol level you have a reliable connection based connection stream, stream of communication implemented. Okay, so what's interesting is that usually UDP is considered to be the faster protocol, right? Because it doesn't need all this synchronization overhead and the how to get a reliable connection. But the interesting thing is that once you want to build something reliable on top of UDP, you usually end up with the same performance as TCP. So, yeah. Okay, then we of course have another authentication layer, the presentation layer, and then the application layer, right? Which is which implements some more sophisticated protocols on top of TCP, right? So if you go to a website, you usually talk HTTP, right? Where you instead of having some byte stream, right, you usually have some, well, it's still a byte stream, but you interpret it as a specific text, right? And you can do all sorts of things with it. I don't know if you have experience with doing HTTP requests or something like that, right? No. Another example for application layer protocol is SSH, right, which you used for to get a remote connection to a Unix-based computer, for example, IMAP for email, for your email mailbox, and so on, right? So the problem, however, is that for our supercomputers, well, we really don't need all those layers, right? Each of the layer adds some form of overhead, right? Which is a little problematic, right? So, for example, we also have some redundancies in our layering model. We have a Ethernet address, of course, right? And on top of that, we have another IP address. And yeah, that's kind of doubling functionality. And well, we don't actually need it, right? The other problem is that the layering model, so how the layering model is usually implemented is that the application layer is in the user space most of the time, and the network data link and physical layer is hidden behind the operating system calls. Okay, that means that we have to copy our data into the kernel space somehow, and then the kernel sends the packages over the network, so it talks to the network adapter, and that requires multiple data copies, context switches, and so on and so forth. Okay, so we don't really need that kind of things. Okay, so what we want to have in a supercomputer setting is that we need a very lightweight communication. Okay, that means that we want to directly talk to the network card, okay, and avoid data copies, avoid context switches, avoid all the layering overheads. Okay, what this means in particular is that, for example, the InfiniBand design came up. So InfiniBand can be used completely in user space. That means that we can directly talk to the hardware and directly say to the hardware, hey, I want to transfer this buffer, okay, send it, and notify me whenever the packet's there, and without any context switches or whatever, right? And the way how it's designed is that it's based on some kind of switches, so you always need switches in between them. You have a fixed maximum transfer unit, which you so the transfer unit is on the data link layer. So each packet that goes over the network has a fixed length, right? And the addressing is done via local IDs and global IDs. Okay, so the local IDs are usually what you is usually the address of your interface adapter, and the global ID is assigned to you by the switches you connect your stuff into. Okay, and the in addition, we have a subnet manager, which actually takes care of the assignment of the global IDs and the whole topology that's built on it. So if you look at a InfiniBand network from the outside, it doesn't look too different from an Ethernet network. Okay, so you have switches like you have for Ethernet. You have network adapters which you put into your compute node, and you somehow connect them together, right? So then you connect the different compute nodes to the switches. Then you use the switches to build up some kind of topology. Okay. The nice thing is that they also kind of handle the case where you have different hardware, so not only processing nodes, compute nodes, but also some kind of storage subsystems and routers to other networks. Okay, so yeah. So the links inside of a InfiniBand cable are serial, right? So you have one cable where you send a serial stream of information along them, and each lane, and each link or each lane has a specific speed, right? So you have single data rate, double data rate, quadruple data rate, and now we are at XDR, where we are somewhere here, right? And so they try to improve the bandwidth of a, so the InfiniBand improves the bandwidth by improving the lane speeds and adding more lanes, right? So the more lanes we have, the faster we can communicate, right? So this is a little older slide. So what we had in 2011 is that we had 26 gigabit per second. And nowadays, as I mentioned, we have between 56 gigabits per second and 112 gigabits per second. Okay. So that's for a single lane, and if we have a dual port 4x FDR InfiniBand adapter, we would get 52 gigabits per second with a, and the nice thing is that we get a 1 microsecond latency with it. Okay. So the architecture behind it is that you don't communicate with things like TCP sockets. Who have you ever programmed a socket-based application, server or client? Kind of, okay. So, Yeah, okay. So, what do you have to do when communicating via TCP is that you usually have to open a socket, right, which is your connection to the network interface card. You have to bind it to a specific port to be in order to communicate with your peer, right? The design in InfiniBand is different. Here you communicate via queue pairs. Okay. That means that you have a queue pair for sending and receiving, right? And if you want to open a connection, you have to you have to create a queue pair on both sides, okay, and send the ID, send the identifier of the queue pair to the remote side with a different communication channel, okay. But once you have the queue pairs connected, you have a send queue and a receive queue on both ends, right? And if you send out a packet, you dispatch it to the network card, right? The network card processes it, so it ends up in the send queue, and once the send is completed, it gets into the completion queue, right? And the application usually polls the state of the completion queue, right? And then knows how whenever a send or a receive operation has been completed, right? So the if you send something, the hardware processes the send request, puts it into the receive queue of the other of the receiving queue pair. Right, and once the receive operation is completed, it will be put in the completion queue, and then the consumer, so the application, gets notified that you have a new receive, and then you can handle that receive. Right, so that the thing is that for each send, you have to post a specific receive at the other end, right? So if you sent something and you didn't post the matching receive on the receiving end, the packet will just get dropped. Well, it will be ignored as long as you don't post the matching receive buffer. Okay, so the other nice thing is that you can get remote direct memory access, which means that you don't only have to have this send and receive pairs, but you can actually have special operations where you can get the memory from a remote host, right? You get direct access to memory of your remote host. In order to do that, you need to register the memory that you want to expose to the other nodes, right? Then you get a specific handle, which you can then send to the other nodes, and the other nodes can then read or write depending on the permissions on that piece of memory, and that's completely circumventing the queue pairs. Okay, you only need to have you only put it in the send queue pair. Send queue. Then it will get processed, and you will get notified on only on your end of the communication side.
Different port for each
Q. You can have as many queue pairs as you want. Okay, so you don't have ports in InfiniBand. Okay.
Well, because if you have many applications in the system, you will need an identifier for each application to know which. So we have the competition queue, and the thing is that you need to tell the application that message is for you or for another application.
Right. Yeah. So if you start up an application and want to use your InfiniBand hardware, you create a thing called protection domain. Okay. That protection domain means that the protection domain is the protection mechanism. You can kind of compare it to the virtual address spaces for operating systems, right? Where you theoretically can't access the other process's memory, right? And so each queue pair is associated with a specific protection domain, right? But the protection domain is purely local to the application, right? It's a pure local implementation. But so you have to communicate, you have to exchange your queue pair IDs, etc. So you can actually talk to each other, right? So it's a completely user space based model, so to say, right? So the well, the properties of your HPC systems is usually that they are a closed system, right? So you can't really talk to the high performance network from the outside, right? That's impossible. So also the applications that run on a supercomputer are, well, most of the time isolated, right? So the environment you compute in is a very friendly environment, right? So the users on a supercomputer usually don't spy on each other, right? And for that, you don't have a lot of security mechanisms in there. Okay.
Yeah, so that's why, they are taking out all the security part of TCP and doing it more free to them to.
Well, as I mentioned, you have to exchange the information somehow, right? And that's usually done via TCP, right? So you have to have some kind of startup mechanism to bootstrap the system. And you can do that, for example, with TCP. Yeah. And you can also implement TCP on top of InfiniBand. Okay.
In the application manager?
No, it's in the kernel. So let me show you. So here's an example of one machine. Okay. No. Okay. Sorry. So I have my regular Ethernet adapter, right? And it's not connected. Yay. I want to have, yeah, so it's, so I have my bridge adapter, right? Where you see it's an Ethernet card, right? It has a IP address, broadcast address, your IP version 6 address. You have your hardware address, and yeah, so yeah, like that. Then you can also have your InfiniBand hardware, right? Where the where you have the very same information, where you have your IP address, your broadcast address. So that means that it's talking over IP, right? So TCP/IP, basically. And the link here is, well, unfortunately unspecified, right? So that's the data link and physical layer, right? So you can actually use InfiniBand without a problem, right? So TCP over InfiniBand isn't a problem at all. So here you see, so with the IP tool, you actually see that the link is InfiniBand, right? The hardware address is a little bit more complicated, right? But that's the basic idea. So
hardware address is MAC address.
The hardware address, it's not the MAC address in that example.
It used like a MAC address and it works like that.
It kind of works like a MAC address, yeah. Okay. What's going on? Okay, this is missing. One second. Okay, this is missing everything. Okay, so I can't show it to you right now. Anyways, yeah, it's like a MAC address, yeah. So let's put it that way. It's built up of the global identifier and the local identifier, Okay. It's just some made up MAC address, which is not a valid one, so to say. Okay. And so the MAC address for the Ethernet card is essentially the Ethernet address, right? Which you don't necessarily need for using InfiniBand. Okay, where you only need the where you only need your local and global identifier. Okay, I wanted to show you that.
Because InfiniBand is not for local
networks. It's usually used only for local networks. Yeah. Yeah, let me try something. Maybe I can. Haha. No. I think it's down. Come on. Doesn't have the tools installed. I might show to you next time how all this looks like. So anyways, that's the basic idea of InfiniBand, right? And so what you then do is you have a very different layering, right? So you have your subnet management agent and the web provider, which is usually implemented as a kernel module, right? Where you can talk to the actual network device. Then you have your additional drivers, which take care of accessing the actual InfiniBand layer, right? And you have additional drivers. So for example, to use TCP over InfiniBand, or have specific other InfiniBand-based capabilities exposed from within the kernel. Then you have your user mode verbs library, right, which talks to the InfiniBand access layer in the kernel and is able to directly circumvent the kernel mode and directly talk to the network interface, right? On top of that, you have your application that accesses the InfiniBand verbs library. So you have some kind of user mode access layer where the protocol and all the high-level stuff is completely implemented by the application, right? But you could still use your regular TCP/IP-based communication. So, as I mentioned earlier, some data centers actually equip their network with InfiniBand hardware nowadays, right? But what they do is they don't actually change the software that's running on top of it, but they just use the TCP stack on top of the InfiniBand hardware, right? Which is feasible. So that I can show you, however. So if I, so here's my InfiniBand hardware on this specific node, right? And, and my IP address, right? So this is for the Ethernet card, and this is for the InfiniBand card, right? So if I want to ping it, the IP address, right? If I want to ping the IP address of the InfiniBand card, I get a delay of about 0.3 microseconds, milliseconds. Okay. If I, on the other hand, ping the InfiniBand hardware, I get 0.1 microseconds, right? So even if I talk over the IP layer, I still get some speed up, right? Just because I used the different hardware. Okay. All right.
But your opinion, if anyone have what is inside the same computer or the other computer?
That's different. That's a different computer. So this one here, right, has. So I pinged 110, right, and. This one here has 242, right? So it's a different computer. If I would ping locally, right, it shouldn't matter that much. No. Right, it's no difference there, because it detects or the kernel is intelligent enough that it's a local operation, right? So it's just, but you see, it's way faster, right? So, yeah. All right. So again. We program the InfiniBand devices via what's called InfiniBand Verbs, which is an API, a standardized API. There's the Open Fabrics Alliance, which defines the API. So there are multiple vendors that actually produce the InfiniBand hardware. And you can talk with this InfiniBand hardware with those verbs, right? And the verbs are kind of simple operations which can be completely implemented in hardware, right? So you have different verbs or function calls for setting up the queue pair, sending the data, etc., right? And the advantage here is that you can achieve a complete zero copy communication protocol, right? So the data is being directly read from the registered buffer. So in order to send something, you have to send it, you have to register it with the InfiniBand adapter, and then you only send your descriptor off the buffer that you want to send, right? And then the hardware directly reads from that memory region, right? And at the receive side, it's the very same, where you have to register some memory where you actually receive your data into, right? And of course, we can have arbitrary topologies with it. So here's a overview of the different classes and how they relate to each other, right? Where we have the protection domain, we have different data link protocols. We can have reliable datagrams, we can have unreliable datagrams, etc. We have to have something to create a completion queue, right? Once we have the completion queue, we can create a queue pair. And something to register memory with it, and then once we have the queue pair, we can also send some work requests, right? So where we post sends, post receives, poll the completion queue, and so on and so forth. The RDMA functionality isn't in that slide, but yeah. It's very similar, okay. Any questions regarding InfiniBand? Okay, so fortunately you don't have to use the very low level InfiniBand Verbs API, right? And it would also be very bad because there are more networks than InfiniBand. What you want to use, or what's being used usually to program the your distributed computer is that you have some kind of message passing implemented, right? So the programming of shared memory systems is what we covered already, right? So for multiple cores, you can have OpenMP or anything else that just spawns multiple threads and uses the different CPU cores, right? Eventually, however, due to the global address space, due to shared resources, etc., we reach some scalability limits, right? And for the time being, all top 500 systems are distributed memory machines, right? So we have shared memory systems on the node level, and those different nodes are connected via the via some high performance network with each other to make up a distributed memory model. That means that each node has their separate memory attached to it, and each node needs to have a separate process, and those separate processes talk to each other via some communication network, right? And the synchronization is then done via passing messages to each other, okay? So the network is also typically a little slower than your shared memory, but the question now is whether it's harder to program a distributed memory application. I guess so. And how to use different networks, right? So if you have different kinds of networks. So for example, the typical example is that you have your separate nodes, right? And then on your node, you have two CPUs. On the CPU, you have your different islands, your different packages. And then on your node, you probably also have some kind of accelerator, for example, a graphics card. Right, and all those have different networks with different properties. So the question is how to use them efficiently. But that's not our concern right now. What we care about is to have a means to use to implement our message passing in order to support the distributed memory machines. Okay, so we have various standards for network communication, for higher level network communication. Where we have, at the very first, we have the remote procedure calls, okay? So, for example, most of the modern internet nowadays is more or less implemented via remote procedure calls, right? So if you have a web service, it implements an API, right? And that's more or less a remote procedure call, right? Where you type in some URL and send some data to that URL, you invoke a procedure on that remote host, right? And examples for that are Java remote method invocation, Corba, XML remote procedure call, SOAP, or REST, or whatever, right? So the very nice thing is that you get a very high compatibility, right? So it doesn't matter how your web service is implemented, right? At least as soon as it understands your JSON request, for example, right? It can deal with it. That also means that we have a very high protocol overhead, right? Because we always have to translate to this common text protocol and translate back to our native language protocol, so to say, to our native data structures in order to compute, right? But the compatibility is very, very high, right? And that's very visible on today's internet, right? Where where Google, Facebook, Amazon, and whatnot talk to each other more or less directly. And that's all done via remote procedure calls, right? Since we have the relatively high protocol overhead, that's not something we want to use in our high performance computing setup. So what we want to use instead is the message passing interface, or short MPI, right? Back in the day when the distributed memory machines in the scientific computing community came up, we had two competing designs. One was the parallel virtual machine and one was MPI. Okay, so they both had kind of similar goals, but PVM eventually lost against the MPI forks, and all the ideas from PVM, if not too complicated, were merged into MPI. Okay, and MPI is just the definition of an API, right? It's not a specific implementation, okay, but it's the standard for distributed parallel computers nowadays, right? So there is a MPI forum, which is a group of different people from the industry, and they define the API that's being used. And then we have multiple competing implementations, right? So if you, for example, you can compare it to C programming language or C++ or whatever, where you have one standard, right, where the behavior of the language, the functions that the standard library of the language has are defined, but you have different implementations, right? For the programming languages, it would be, for example, Microsoft, Intel, the GNU compiler collection, or the LLVM tools, right? In the very very similar fashion, we have the same for MPI. Right, which implement the API as it has been standardized. Right, and we have different vendor-specific implementations. So we have Intel MPI, we have Hewlett-Packard MPI, we have MPI MPI, we have Open MPI, which is a complete open source implementation. We have MPitch, which is also open source, and a derivative from it, which is called MVAPitch, which is specifically designed for InfiniBand hardware, right? And those vendor-specific implementations are usually forked off of MPitch, okay? And they usually just implement the different hardware specifics of the underlying network, okay? Or the underlying topology or not, right? And that means that by today we have kind of very high efficient implementations of the message passing interface. Okay, the implementations, however, are not binary compatible with each other, right? So if you have a two programs compiled with, for example, one with Intel MPI and one with Open MPI, they can't directly talk to each other, right? So the actual protocol of the data exchange isn't specified. Okay, so you can't talk with all your processes that are part of an MPI program have to be have to talk the same language. That means that they have to be compiled with the same MPI implementation. Okay, so most of the MPI implementations usually come with some kind of compiler wrapper, right? Which which adds the necessary libraries to your link path and sets the include path, so you can just type in MPICC, your program, and be done with it, right? So.
But what I have so often in this kind of protocols, they use API too.
MPI?
API.
So they have what they have in common is that they specify the data exchange format, right? So it's completely language agnostic, and the binary representation, etc., is completely fixed. Okay.
So they are just language.
Hmm?
So there is just a high level language, and
it's very high level. Yeah.
The bottom source, it doesn't matter if you use SOAP or you use.
You obviously can't. So a SOAP application can't talk to an XML RPC application.
Cannot.
No. You have to have some kind of translation layer, right? So if you,
But they use XML, no? Or everybody uses XML?
The Java remote method invocation doesn't use XML. They use the Java binary format to exchange the data. Corba. The remaining three are XML based, right? What we see nowadays in web services is usually JSON based, right? What this means is, for example,
JSON REST.
Hmm?
JSON REST.
JSON is REST, yeah. So, for example, your GitHub, right, the source repository thing, they define a REST API, right? And what you have, for example, is, so let's look at this, right, where you post a specific request, right? So let's see if I can get it right. Oh, no. So there you go. Yeah, so that's how it works, right? You have your you connect, huh?
Curl minus I is a request,
huh? No, curl is a program. And that you essentially talk to the web services via the HTTP protocol. Okay, and the HTTP protocol defines different ways. So it has a get and a post, essentially, right? With a get, you just retrieve something. With a post, you can actually post data, right? The other thing is that you can have different headers for the HTTP message, right? And that's how you essentially talk to the API, right? And what you get back is some form of JSON string, right? And also what the arguments are, some kind of JSON string, right? Or JSON format. And this is complete text-based. This is a complete text-based protocol, right? So the binary format is fixed because it's UTF-8 most of the time. Right? UTF-8, Unicode, okay? So you can essentially talk that way with each other, okay? But the for MPI, the protocol on how the data is exchanged isn't specified, right? It could be done via a REST API, for example, completely feasible, right? But most of the time, it's just a stream of binary data, okay? And that's interpreted by the MPI implementation. Okay? That's why they are not compatible with each other. Okay, so if you send a stream of bits, right, it depends on the receiving end how they interpret the stream of bits, right? Could be a number, right? Then you have to determine how long the number is, so how many bits a number consists of, and so on and so forth. Okay. Right. So the compiler wrapper. This is very. You have your compiler wrapper, right? Which is essentially just wrapping GCC, right? And you can actually tell it to show the actual command line, right? So it expands to something like this, where the compiler is invoked, one include path, the link libraries, the link paths, right, and so on and so forth, right? And then you can easily compile a MPI application, so a very stupid Hello World application, right? MPI Hello World, where you just, so if I would just say GCC or G++ for in this instance, I will get a lot of problems, right? So in this specific case, I will get a lot of undefined references, right? But if I compile it with the compiler wrapper, then it links, and I have my binary, which I can run when I run it like this. So without anything else, I just get a single process, right? If I do a MPI run, I can specify the number of processes, right? And then we get a total of 8 processes, and each puts out their ID or their rank that they have, right? This is just running on a single node, right? But I can use multiple nodes. For example, this is running on a single node. Come on. Okay, something's wrong. Anyways.
But a single node with many cores.
This is just a a 12 core machine. Okay. Yeah. So if you run on EMI, right, you would use you would look up in the documentation on how to use MPI programs, right? Then you would write your batch job, which starts the MPI program, right? And then you would run on multiple nodes. Okay. Good. So, yeah. So the way that that MPI works is that it's a so-called single program, multiple data programming paradigm. That means that, as I mentioned, we have a single program, right? But the each process works on a different set of data, right? So single program, multiple data. So usually what we have is that each CPU runs one process, right? We can also have hybrid programming where we have only one process per node, and then on the node we have a different parallelization strategy, and each of the processes are identified by a rank, right? And MPI by itself provides functions for point-to-point communication, collective communication, barriers, and remote memory access, right? And we can also have things like user-derived data types to specify some data type that we used in our application. We can set up different communicators, right, where we can partition our processes, and we can dynamically add new processes to the MPI application. And also very important for larger scale programs is that we have parallel I/O. Right? And so here again is another MPI Hello World code, right? And what we see is that we first have to initialize MPI. Okay, this sets up the whole communication infrastructure. So does this exchange of information, where to find the different processes, how they are called, what our ID, our rank in the MPI application is, what the total size is, and so on and so forth, right? We can then query MPI. We can first ask what our rank is and what the total size is, right? This is an example which works with two MPI processes, right? Where we have, if we are rank 0, we first send a message to rank 1. We send one message. We have one element. We send one double to rank 1 with a tag of 1 and in the world communicator. Next, we receive the message from node 1, with a tag 1, okay? And on the other node, we first receive the message and then send our message back, right?
And how much is size?
Size is the number of processes, right? So if I started with 2 processes, size will be 2, right? And so every send operation must have the corresponding receive operation on the remote node, on the receiving node, right? So this is an example of a blocking send, right? So this function only returns when the remote process, when the remote rank actually received the message. And the remote process only receives the message once it calls the actual receive thingy, right? If we would switch those two statements, right, then we would get a deadlock, right? Because the send cannot complete because the send on the other end hasn't been completed as well. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So yeah, right. The as I said, the send and receive is first you pass in a buffer to your data, then the number of items you have in your buffer, then the data type, the destination rank, and the tag, right, which is some kind of port, if you like, and the communicator, right? And the receive call, so it has to match the specific receive call on the destination, right? And the receive call is symmetric to the send call, where we, instead of the destination, put in the source rank, right? And those are examples for blocking communication calls. We can also have asynchronous communication with I send and I receive, where we can wait for the completion. Barrier, broadcast, scatter, and gather are, and all to all are examples for global communication primitives. Okay, so that's it. Okay, thanks.